Montage Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan here in the KRCB studio with my co-host Gary Carnevelli, and on the boards tonight, Mary Moore Campagna. We have a very exciting show for you. First, Gary will speak with film director Andrew Hay about his new movie, Weekend, which actually opened this month in the Bay Area theaters. Big hit at the San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival. Later, Gary will chat with Rachel Gardner about Food for Thought's big upcoming benefit, Calabash. We'll also play music by a few artists you may not be too familiar with, but certainly whose music you're sure to love. First up, let's go to Greg Moralia with the Outbeat News and Calendar.
Say.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, September 18th, 2011. A gay music director at a New Jersey Roman Catholic church, once led by gay 911 hero Michael Judge, is leaving because of the current pastor's remarks against homosexuality. According to the New Jersey newspaper The Record, Robert Russell, who has been a music minister at St. Joseph Parish in the East Rutherford area for 22 years, is resigning effective September 30th because of statements the Reverend Joseph Astorita made from the pulpit, such as, "Marriage between two men is a lie." Astorita, who became pastor of the church in July, made the statements about marriage in a July 10 sermon. Russell told the paper in an interview Wednesday, "My feelings at that point was to walk out, but I didn't because I have a responsibility to the choir and the church." Russell said the comment was insensitive and uncomfortable. He met with Astorita the following month to discuss the comments and to reveal that he was gay and that he had a partner of 15 years. Russell said the priest expressed concern about his involvement in a proposed children's choir and told him he would be a, quote, poor example, and he suggested he could change his sexuality through therapy. Other members of the parish said St. Joseph has traditionally been a liberal parish, but has now become ultra-conservative and is losing members because of that. It was run by the Franciscans, a Catholic religious order, for 99 years, but because of staffing shortages, St. Joseph's was turned over to the Catholic Archdiocese of Newark in July. Astorita was installed as pastor after the change. And a 7-year-old is being denied use of a boys' bathroom by officials at a rural Georgia school district, even though his transgender father says his child, born female, identifies as male. Known as D, the child began exhibiting signs he was transgender at only 18 months, telling his father that he was a boy. Tommy Thielen, 28, is the child's father and gave birth to D just a year before transitioning to male himself. D encountered a few problems when he attended a liberal Atlanta school, but when Thielen moved the child to McIntosh County, some teachers were resistant to allowing D to use male facilities. After Thielen met with the McIntosh School District Superintendent, the official threatened to call Child Protective Services. Today, Thielen plans to present the McIntosh School Board with over 40,000 signatures supporting D and his use of male facilities. And here in Sonoma County, the Guerneville Resort, formerly known as the Russian River Resort, will now be called R3. It opened its doors Friday to its friends and neighbors for a festive champagne and cake event. The new owner, who is actually a former owner, hopes the 23-room resort along with the bar and restaurant will be open for business in early October. Ray Allen owned the Triple R from 1992 to 2005 and sold the resort to previous owner Ray Shahani so he could retire. The popular gay resort has been closed for the last year after it went into foreclosure because Shahani failed to make his payments to Sterling Savings Bank. The sudden closure and padlocking of the Triple R came as a shock to both the citizens of the resort town and the tourists who have enjoyed the establishments since it became gay-identified in 1980. Despite the new name, the resort will look to its heyday to bring tourists from all over the world back to the Russian River. The Russian River Resort served as an epicenter to the area, which enjoyed a reputation as being one of the U.S.'s premier LGBT tourist resort spots. The area's businesses began to experience a slowdown, along with many resort spots, after 9/11 and after the flood of 2002. Allen has a big job in his hands, but along with personal and professional partner Paul McBride, the former general manager of Fife's Resort Glenn Dixon, and the dedicated employees he has, he hopes to make the resort better than ever. And finally, October 11th is National Coming Out Day, and throughout the month, the Outbeat Radio team will feature coming out stories. If you'd like to come out on the radio or share your coming out story, email Sheridan at outbeatradio.org. Now here's your calendar of events for the coming week. On Tuesday, September 20th at 6:30 p.m., the Transgender North Bay Group will meet at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. And at 7 p.m. the same night, the new volunteer orientation is scheduled at Food for Thought. That's Sonoma County's AIDS Food Bank, 6550 Railroad Ave in Forestville. And on Friday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m., PFLAG North Bay meets at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, you can tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat Radio News. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage right here on KRCB-FM, Santa Rosa.
The KRCB Radio Fall Pledge Drive began Monday, September 12th, but you may not have noticed because we've made a few changes. You see, without your participation, great radio can't happen, and great radio means fewer pledge breaks. In fact, we're not doing any pledge breaks at all. Just quick, one-minute reminders. Simple and streamlined. Why make it any harder? Best of all, your favorite programming continues uninterrupted. We also know that Pledge Drive is really all about you. KRCB connects you to your favorite programming, and we're asking you to make a connection with us at krcb.org. Help nurture a community that you believe in and want to be part of. Be the one listener who makes a difference. You can become the power of one. We'll get to Gary's interview right after this wonderful track by Deb Barber, fresh off of her CD, The Best of Life. This is a little bit of mm-mm.
She said to laugh, Welcome back to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale. We're thrilled to have joining us tonight filmmaker Andrew Hay, whose new film Weekend opens in Bay Area theaters this week. Andrew is the film's writer, director, and editor. The critically acclaimed film was snatched up for distribution by IFC last March after it won the Emerging Visions Audience Award at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas. In June, Weekend played the Castro Theater during Frameline's 35th San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival. I had the pleasure of seeing the film and must say it was my favorite feature of the festival and perhaps the best queer film I've reviewed this year. Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Andrew.
Hi, good to be here.
Great to have you. Talk about a bit about your educational background.
I did university in the UK. I studied history, actually, so no kind of film background there. But then I started working in the industry as an assistant editor on kind of all kinds of films, lots of American films when they came to shoot in the UK. And then I actually went to LA for a year about 6 years ago now and did a one-year course out there, which was pretty good. Got to use lots of equipment and practice a few things. And then back to the UK, continued working, and then started making my own films, really.
So what made you decide to venture out and start making your own films?
Well, I think I always wanted to do it, but it's just, you know, you need to live and earn some money. So I kind of started out kind of working my way up, and then in the end just thought, you know, I could stay doing this forever, and now's the time to just go out and do it by myself, I think.
Tell us a bit about your short films.
I actually made two short films that were in, I shot in America a long, long time ago now, about 6 years ago, and another one I made about 4 years ago that played in Berlin, played in quite a lot of festivals, and it's funny, I kind of look back at them now, and they were certainly testing grounds, I think, for what I'm doing now more than anything else.
Which film directors do you most admire?
That's a hard one. I mean, I suppose mainly, actually, American filmmakers, even though I'm from the UK. So there's a lot of filmmakers working at the moment that I really like. People like Kelly Reichardt, Raman Barani, and then there's people like Gus Van Sant and Todd Haynes, who I've really admired for a long time. And so a real kind of mixture, and then back to a lot of films from the 70s. Again, especially American films from the 70s, which have always been kind of what I've watched growing up and what I've liked.
The best decade, one of the best decades for filmmaking.
Amazing decade. It was like they were making kind of really interesting, kind of radical films, but they're also relatively commercial at the same time. There's a really good kind of combination, I think, of the two.
Right,
accessible stories, but still really, really interesting.
And what are some of the films that you liked from the 70s? And what queer films are really important to you?
In terms of like just films from the 70s, my favourites, I love things like Five Easy Pieces, Point Blank. There's so many. I mean, you could just kind of spend months just watching films from that period. In terms of queer films, it's really interesting because there's a few British films that I kind of grew up watching, like Beautiful Things, this kind of sweet English film, and maybe My Beautiful Laundrette, those kind of seminal English queer films.
Yes.
And then in terms of American ones, it's interesting. I've like, there's a lot that I've watched, but I think my influences have come from not queer film rather than from queer film, if that makes sense.
Your first feature, 2009's Greek Pete, follows the life of a very expressive gay male escort and kind of blurs the boundaries between fiction and documentary.
Yeah.
Talk about the making of Greek Pete.
That was an interesting one because I had no real notion of what the film was going to be, or anything really. I just thought I knew nothing about that world, and I thought it would be an interesting kind of world to document. And then I put an advert out, met some of these guys, and then kind of created a fictional kind of vague fictional story based on their lives with them starring in the film. So it was a really unusual process, and I didn't know what was going to come of it. And then I finished it, and then some people liked it, some people didn't like it. I got it out there. It did pretty well in the UK, you know, in terms of very independent-wise. But I think more than anything, I took from that film a kind of documentary approach that I brought into this film, even though this is, you know, pure fiction and entirely scripted. I kind of brought that documentary element that I kind of picked up from that film.
When did the idea for Weekend first come to you, and how did the story evolve while you were writing the screenplay?
It's been something I've wanted to do for a while. It's kind of always been kind of playing around in the back of my mind, probably 3 or 4 years, and it was really just that I felt like there weren't many gay-themed films that reflected my experiences or how I see the world or... yeah, just the gay experience as I see it, I suppose. And I wanted to just try and tell a story that was honest and realistic and authentic, just about two guys meeting and spending this time together. So that was my kind of main goal at the beginning, and then it was to try and widen it out a little bit, deal with kind of other themes that weren't just about sexuality and, you know, kind of become a bigger story, I suppose. But at the beginning, it was just wanting to see on the screen an honest depiction of two guys.
And you do a great job sort of representing the start of a gay male relationship and then placing that relationship in a society that is less than completely accepting.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the other important themes in the film.
Well, I think it's, I mean, for me, a lot of gay films deal with kind of coming out and repressed love and all that kind of thing. I just wanted to steer clear of that. And to me, you know, the lead character of this film is just carrying this kind of weight of prejudice or this weight of being different around with him all his life, and just hasn't quite been able to kind of get over that. That's how I see his character. And then I think that kind of widens out to include both the characters and just their desire to try and sort their lives out and work out where they fit in and work out what they want from their life. So they're the kind of things I was interested in dealing with, and of course that incorporates a lot of kind of the gay struggle and how the outside world sees them and how they see themselves and kind of the continual struggle that can come from being different.
For those of our listeners who haven't seen Weekend, offer them a short synopsis.
I always find that so difficult. It's a funny one. I mean, I suppose it is about two guys who meet each other and they spend a weekend together. And over that weekend, they get to know each other, they fall for each other, and I suppose they both find ways to move on with their lives, I think.
So talk about writing the screenplay. Talk about your process.
It was quite a long process, actually, because I wanted it to feel as natural as possible, and essentially as unscripted as possible. It was really about stripping away kind of stuff that felt artificial and, you know, written, I suppose. So the story is quite simple in how it develops, but it was about getting those themes to be working under the surface throughout and get you to slowly start to fall for these characters, like you would when you, you know, meet someone and spend a weekend with them. So it was just trying about being subtle and keeping enough information there and letting things being revealed at the right time, and also just always staying true to what I was trying to do and not worry if people, you know, I don't know, thought it was too gay, for example. I didn't worry about things like that. I just stuck true to what I wanted to do.
And Weekend is very much a character-driven film, and the film works so well because those characters are portrayed by two very talented actors.
Yeah.
Talk about how you came to cast Tom Cullen and Chris New as your leads.
We did a very kind of relatively long casting process. So we had a really good casting director came on board, and she found like 150 people, and we whittled that down. And I would see people individually, give them bits of the script, but I would get them to improvise so I could see what they were kind of really like. And then I started seeing people in pairs, and when I saw Chris and Tom together, they were so perfect. there was just kind of a spikiness between how they interacted with each other that I thought would come across really well as chemistry. And so that's what we worked on. And I pretty much after I saw them, I knew they were the right people. And they did a great job. They were completely committed to, you know, doing what I wanted them to do, and they were perfect. They were great.
They were great. So tell us about the filming of Weekend, which happened in Nottingham, England, and why did you decide to set your film there?
Why did I set it in Nottingham?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was important to me that I didn't set it in London. I think it's very easy for gay-themed films to be set in like big urban centres, or you know, right out in the middle of nowhere, where you know nobody accepts gay people. Mm. But for me, I wanted somewhere in the middle, you know, a city. There's people there. There's a gay population there. There's gay clubs, but it's not London. It's not like a liberal haven. So I think it was important to me that I set it in a city like that. And also, it's visually, it's different. You know, you don't have to film Big Ben. You know, if you shoot in London, you know, it's different.
Right, right.
You know, and also, I think then it becomes more universal because it's just a city that people don't really recognize.
Hmm.
So it could just be any city.
Any city, right.
Yeah.
Right.
In England, or, you know, it could be Pittsburgh, or not that I've been to Pittsburgh, but, you know, anywhere else, just not a major, major kind of metropolis.
Mm-hmm. That everyone recognizes.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you go about securing the funding to make Weekend?
Yeah, that was a little bit tricky. We tried a few kind of, the regular sources of income that you go to, sources of funding that you can find in the UK, and they were all, you know, concerned with the subject matter, and you'd think they wouldn't in this day and age, but they still were. But then in the end we found a regional funding body that's based up in Nottingham, and they were happy to put the money into the film, and they were great. They never questioned, you know, what we were doing. They were very open to it. They never wanted changes. The content to them was fine, so it was really supportive, so we were very lucky, I think.
You received the film received a great review by Paul Brunick in what I consider the film critic's bible, the magazine Film Comment.
Yeah, amazing.
So talk about your response to that review and the critical response to your film and how you react to both positive and not so positive reviews.
It's a very strange one. It's like when you get a review like the one in Film Comment, it's amazing. You're like, I couldn't even, you know, it's like the perfect review. That was wonderful, and it's amazing to hear. And when you get good reviews, obviously you feel so happy, but maybe it's just me, but I usually focus on the ones that aren't as good. They seem to linger in my mind more. I don't know why that is. I think, not that I expect everyone to like the film, or that it's going to please everyone, but I don't know. It's tough sometimes when someone doesn't get your film, or they don't like your film, but it's part of the process, it's part of everything. It feels a little bit like when you read, because there's so many different ways that people review films nowadays. So there's so many blogs and sites and all kinds of things. And especially on certain blogs, if they don't like something, they will let you know. So it's kind of strange. It's like being at school and the class bully's writing something about you on a desk or something. You kind of come across it on the internet. But, you know, it's all part of it. You know. And luckily for this, people have been very positive about it, so it's really good.
I could imagine. So how many film festivals have accepted Weekend, and which were your favorites to attend?
So we started in March, and at the moment we've only played in America. We've got our European premiere coming up in soon, and it's coming out in the UK later. It's so complicated. You have to, you know, your festival program becomes such a complicated thing. But we've played in probably 15, 16 festivals in the US. And I haven't been to all of them, but South by Southwest was brilliant. And then BAM Cinema Fest in New York was brilliant. And then Frameline has been great. Mm-hmm. And they're all such different festivals. It's really interesting to see the different crowds, different reactions. It's been really good.
So what did it mean for you to screen your film at the Castro Theater here in San Francisco?
It's the Castro. Like, you just have, you know, when I write, I'd flown in from New York the day of the screening. I was quite exhausted, and I hate flying, so I hadn't got any sleep or anything. And then you get to the Castro, to the street, and it's like, okay, I'm here now. And suddenly you're wide awake and happy, and then the cinema's incredible, right? It's just so beautiful, and so much history. history, and the crowds are so enthusiastic there. And it was a busy screening. It was sold out, and it was amazing. It was wonderful. And you stand there, and obviously you're a bit nervous, but it's great. I mean, it's San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when you make a gay film, you want to play in San Francisco,
right?
So it's perfect. It's
At Frameline, which is still the largest LGBT film festival in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really important, you know. I think I'm really glad that we got to play there, and, you know, it's quite special.
Was it your first time here at the fest?
I'd actually been here 2 years ago with Greek Pete.
With Greek Pete.
We played in Frameline. And so I was there for that as well. And I've been to San Francisco quite a few times. And any excuse I get, I come racing back.
So what are you working on now?
I've got a couple of projects that are in early kind of writing. So I never say too much about them because they always end up changing so much once I start writing. But I'm hoping to get something underway. But it's funny because when you make a film, you think you've finished it, and then of course you have another year of promoting it and doing things for it. So I haven't actually got a huge amount of work done on my next project. So I need to escape for a while and get some writing done, I think. I plan to do it in America, my next project. I want to film it in America.
Oh, you want to film it here?
Yeah.
And here in the West Coast?
Yes.
Excellent. How long will you be in San Francisco?
A week.
A week, so you're staying for the parade.
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't miss it.
And then go home. And then I'll actually go down to LA after that.
Ah. And you live in London?
I live outside London, a town called Norwich. Mm. I always used to live in London, but I've just moved out to get a little bit of peace and quiet. I think I'm too old now for London.
And so you haven't screened the film in London? You haven't screened?
No. We're playing in... I'm never allowed to name the festival because it's not been released yet. But
oh.
We're playing in a good festival in the UK later in the year.
Great.
So that's going to be our UK premiere, and then it'll be released in the cinemas after that. But it's interesting for us because it's coming out in America before it comes out in the UK, which is different for most UK films. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Excellent. So tell our listeners how they can find out more about Weekend as well as about your earlier work.
So many websites available. So we're on Facebook, so you can find us on that. And then there's also a website, which is www.weekend-film.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. And I have my own website, which is andrewhaigfilm.com, which has details about Weekend and my past work and links to other stuff and all kinds of things. And I think that's about it at the moment. or check with IFC Films.
Oh, right.
Details on the film as well.
Right. Andrew, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
You too.
Best of luck with your brilliant film, and we hope to hear from you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks. Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Mary Carroll. I'm a KRCB listener, programmer, and volunteer. As a listener, I know I can count on KRCB for the exact time, so I don't have to worry about which of the many clocks I look at each day is actually correct. As a programmer, I know the importance of making every minute count, so the show is exactly the right length. And as a volunteer, I'm constantly amazed at how much every person manages to accomplish in the time they have. That's what makes KRCB-FM so great. Every one counts. It truly is the power of each one. And every one of you can count as well. Just take 1 minute to go to krcb.org and make your pledge to help continue our tradition of fine music, news, and entertainment. Every one listener making their one donation. Show your support for KRCB by taking a minute to donate. You too can demonstrate the power of one.
You're listening to KRCB-FM, Santa Rosa's community-powered radio station at 91.1 and 90.9 FM. It's 8:31.
We want to welcome Rachel Gardner from Food for Thought, and she's here tonight to talk about their huge annual party, Calabash, which happens Sunday, October 2nd. Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Rachel.
Hi, Gary. Thanks. I'm really happy to be on the show tonight.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us all about Calabash.
Well, Calabash is a big fundraiser for Food for Thought. It takes place here on the grounds of the food bank in lovely downtown Forestville. And it's a really festive event that shows people a really good time while raising really essential funds for the food bank. We have a silent auction of fine gourd art that's created by about 100 artists all over the Bay Area. And in addition to the silent auction, there's amazing food and wine. We have all things gourd and calabash, so we have musicians playing gourd instruments. The food is served on gourd platters. We have just tours of the gardens, tours of the food bank. It's just a really fun event, and I think it's worth the price of admission just really to see the exhibit of art and what the talented artists in our community do with gourds.
Certainly, certainly. For those who haven't been, describe gourd art. What some of the artists do with gourds, and what they look like, what people can expect to see at Calabash.
Sure. Well, you know, gourds are one of the earliest
art
materials. Yeah, art forms and materials that were used not only for art but for functional and ceremonial objects. And at Calabash, you see the whole range. There's from very traditional sort of Native American style with beads and feathers, and so that kind of a traditional. There's some that incorporate basketry, some that are more functional pieces, and then it sort of runs the whole gamut of people just really using a lot of creativity. With one of the neat things about Calabash is that a lot of the people who do pieces for us are gourd artists. That's mostly what they do, but many work in other media.
Mm-hmm.
So we have people like Donna Jello, who's a metal sculptor who uses copper and silver, incorporates that into his pieces. There are people who are woodworkers that incorporate wood, jewelers that incorporate fine silver and other metals, mm-hmm. Or beads. Some are made into musical instruments. But a lot of people have done incorporating their own techniques and their own, you know, if there may be painters, incorporating that into the gourd form, and then have gotten really turned on to doing gourds and, you know, first for Calabash, but then mm-hmm. that's kind of part of what they do as artists now. So that's a really neat thing.
That is a neat thing. That is a neat thing. So and there's so many beautiful pieces. Talk about the bidding process and how that works.
Yeah, well, we have a wide range of pieces, so anything from, you know, probably, you know, in the $20 range up into several hundred dollars. Each piece has a minimum bid, which is about the third of the value of the piece, and so that's kind of what gets things started, and when guests come to the event, they register and get a number, and as they see things that they're interested in bidding on in the silent auction, they just put their number down on the slip of paper that's by each piece in increments of about $10. And that goes on for a couple of hours, and then the sections start to close, and whoever was the highest bidder gets the piece.
Mm. And have you already collected all the gourd art that will be available at Calabash?
Just about, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're probably going to get a couple of pieces in the next few days, but pretty much we have everything. We have about 95 pieces,
95.
And it's a really strong year. We have some very beautiful pieces. We also have a retail area where there are sort of like gourd ornaments or jewelry or just mm-hmm. gourds that we've just put some kind of a wash, a color on. So if people don't want to, be, you know, not everybody loves the silent auction process, but still may want to purchase something. So we have lots of things available.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about some of the people who are providing the entertainment?
You know, I can't. I know that Doug Gosling, who does a radio show on your station, who's an expert in African music, mm-hmm. is arranging all the musicians.
Oh.
And I'm sorry, I don't know who he's got lined up this year. But
they're always sort of around the gardens. And
oh yeah, there's usually two people playing at once,
mm-hmm.
One in each of the garden areas, and it goes on for the whole length of the event. And in fact, there is somebody, I'm just remembering, a man named Marcus James, who's a very well-known musician. He's not African, but he plays with a lot of African musicians and plays African music. He's a guitarist, and he has performed a lot in the Bay Area, and he's pretty well-known in Sonoma County. And he's going to be there, and that we're hoping is going to be a really big draw this year.
Great, great. So talk about those beautiful gardens.
Well, the gardens are, you know, we've been on this site for, oh, about 11 years, and the gardens were started by Doug Gosling, who's, I was just mentioning, who does the radio show. He's also the head gardener at Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, and he's beyond a master gardener. He's a real garden artist, and so these gardens are about 11 years old, and they are really beautiful. They're here mainly to serve the clients of the food bank by providing, you know, extra food that, in addition to what we purchase, but also to give clients the opportunity to garden with us, just as a healthy activity and a way to be around, you know, other people, to be around birds and butterflies and the healing aspects of just being in the garden. We also get to demonstrate in the garden, you know, just how healthy food is grown and teaching people how to grow food. One thing that I want to mention is that we've just completed an AIDS memorial in the garden, and that's something that people will get to see at Calabash. It's something that we've wanted to have in the garden since it was started here, a place, you know, a place that's just of solace and comfort, and to recognize just what a loss, what a devastating loss there's been in this community from AIDS. And so the memorial is open to anybody and everybody in the community. It's a beautiful installation. There's trickling water. There's a sculptural chair that represents sort of the empty chair, but there's also seating so that you can come and just sit, contemplate, think of people you've lost, and there are leaves, these copper leaves that hang from the arbor. It's a wisteria arbor in the garden.
Oh.
And so anybody who wishes can inscribe on one of these leaves the name of somebody that they've loved and lost to AIDS and have it hanging up there. So we're really hoping that the community will come to know about it and feel comfortable coming and visiting it. And it really feels important, you know, 30 years into the epidemic, to not forget who we've lost.
And Food for Thought has lost several people, I'm sure, volunteers, staff, clients.
Many, many.
I know we miss I personally worked with Michael Onstad and Stuart Schofield, Ed We the People, and a huge loss. They were wonderful.
Yeah, but I mean, a loss to We the People. I mean, the writing that they did for your paper was such a contribution, and with Michael with the AIDS Nutrient Bank, and Stuart, you know, the volunteer manager for 18 years or so here at the food bank. Those are really still losses that we feel tremendously.
Certainly. Talk a bit about your staff and board of directors and the people who and the volunteers also who really make Food for Thought what it is.
Sure. Well, we have a very small staff. We serve now over 650 men, women, and children in the county living with HIV. There's just five of us that are on staff, paid staff here. So we're still a very much a grassroots, volunteer-driven agency. Without volunteers, we wouldn't be able to do the work that we do. There are hundreds of volunteers just over the course of the week that do really everything to operate the food bank. So volunteers wait on clients, you know, when they come in to get groceries, delivery drivers, do food drives at local stores, do data entry, answer the phones, just the whole range of everything it takes to run this place. And the board of directors, I mean, that those are also volunteers, and there are about 12 people on our board of directors, many of whom also volunteer in the food bank, which is really nice. So they really know what they're, you know, who they're serving, and we have a very strong board right now. The volunteers also, I'm not sure if you know about FFT Antiques, which is we have an antique and collectible store in south end of Sebastopol that raises money for the food bank, and that's another opportunity for volunteers. And of course, volunteers help out in the garden. So that's sort of the bread and butter of the food bank.
Mm-hmm. Talk a bit more about the antique store, which is amazing. It's one of the best in Sebastopol, in my opinion.
It's something we kind of happened into. It was actually bequeathed to us, and so we figured, well, let's give it a try and see whether we can run this and how it would work. A man named Alan Shivens runs it with Mark Brzezinski and some other, staff and volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan and Mark are just incredibly creative people. They actually, at Calabash, do the whole display of the artwork for the silent auction.
Oh.
But what they do at the store is tremendous. It's one of those stores that you go into and you don't even know where to look because there's so much, mm-hmm. but there's so much that you want to have. And they display it in a really artistic way. And so their creativity is amazing, and it's become a very profitable enterprise for the food bank. So we're really grateful that we found them and that mm-hmm. they, are as devoted as they are to running it and to the food bank. It's hard to even describe. There are antiques there, mm-hmm. but there's household things. There's just a really wide range of
garden items,
mm-hmm.
and the antique book selection is astounding.
It is.
I was looking and saw, early edition of Catcher in the Rye, and thought, wow, there's a lot there for a reader as well as an antique collector.
And like you said, for the garden or mm-hmm. Household and kitchen items,
right.
And just
China.
Sort of quirky. Mm-hmm. And it's a great place for holiday shopping because you just see things that you that are great gifts. So
mm-hmm.
There are people who I know who just, a couple of times a month just kind of go through there and see what's coming, because things are coming in all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another way that we're really lucky to have tremendous community support that, as people are going through their things and wanting to donate, that mm-hmm. they think of the store. And so we're always getting new items. And we're also starting to do estate sales, which brings in a lot of things to the store and is also a great it's a great way for people in the community to have their estate sales done because, they're supporting a nonprofit
mm-hmm.
while they're getting rid of the things that they need. And we have a lot of volunteers that help, so we just kind of come in and can really go through things, and whatever then doesn't get sold can be taken to the store so we can continue to find takers for them.
That's a lot going on. You're very busy people.
It's a tremendous amount going
mm-hmm.
on, and we love all of it, and it is really true that it's a statement also just I think about what's happening and has been happening in the culture that there's less and less public support,
mm-hmm.
government support for things that nonprofits do.
Right.
This is actually food for thought first year since there was Ryan White funding. That we have, that we no longer get Ryan White funding,
mm-hmm.
so
which
was tremendous. We were getting,
right.
Over $150,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That was cut in half last year, and then this year we have none because of the way that the federal government is sort of shifting where that money goes. So there's still money that comes into the county, but it's all going for direct medical care.
Mm.
Food is not considered a medical necessity, which of course is crazy.
Nutrition and right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're back really to our grassroots and spend a lot of our time in addition to trying to provide really good services to our clients to, having to raise a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
sure.
We do spend a lot of time on it and are always trying to think of new ways that are, not staff intensive to
right.
bring in money to the food bank, but that's a lot of money to replace.
Certainly, certainly. Talk a bit about the programs that you offer your clients.
Sure. Well, anybody who is a resident of Sonoma County and has a diagnosis of being HIV positive is eligible for our services. And we keep it as non-bureaucratic as possible. So it's actually very easy to become a client here if you meet those two qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
And our basic services that we provide, weekly groceries and nutritional supplements and vitamins and other nutritional support to clients. And we serve, like I said, about 650 people right now. About a third are on delivery because they're not well enough or don't have gas money or transportation to come into the food bank. The rest of the clients come in to do their own shopping here. And I think we're a pretty unique place. In addition, of course, to having the garden and all of that, we have a particular way that we, you know, the food bank way of doing things,
mm-hmm.
which is that we really make a point of welcoming people here, treating people with respect, trying to destigmatize both having HIV and coming to a food bank, because there's certainly a lot of, you know, shame that people can feel because they need help in
mm-hmm.
our culture, that
mm-hmm.
we're sort of supposed to, you know, just be independent and do it for ourselves, and with the economy and everything that's going on, not everybody can. And so starting with the garden and having it being really beautiful
mm-hmm.
outside the building, we really try to shift people's experience of what it means to be somebody who's positive
mm-hmm.
and somebody who is needing to come to the food bank for some assistance. And our volunteers are great. It tends to feel very festive here and be very warm and welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
We have a nutritionist that works here one afternoon a week, so we do offer one-on-one nutritional consultations. And also, the nutritionist does twice a month a workshop on a particular topic of interest to people who are living with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have, there's a lot of choice. So, and I think that's also something that's kind of unique here, is that we don't just give people a set bag of food. People can order off of an order form, and there's choices in every category. So however people eat, we try to meet their needs. If they, you know, in terms of what kinds of foods that they like, we have a really wide range. And so it's as much like going to a grocery store as we
mm-hmm.
possibly can. So you could order what you want, and then you also can pick out your own produce. We have a lot of fresh produce and also baked goods and breads and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's such a lovely environment. For people who haven't been, and it's wonderful that you open it up to the public pretty much at Calabash, but, you know, you see a food bank on the evening news, and it's a big warehouse, and people are lined up outside, and Food for Thought has created an HIV community around
mm-hmm.
The idea of a food bank. Tell us about, give us a brief history of Food for Thought, when it started and how it's sort of evolved over the years.
Sure. Well, the food bank's been around since 1988, and it was started, you know, there's lots of stories, lots of people have their versions, because there were a lot of people involved in the very early days. The version that I like to tell people and that I tell to clients is, you know, that there was a group of people who were living out at the river who, you know, knew people who were at that time getting diagnosed with what nobody even knew what it was,
mm-hmm.
And were getting very ill very quickly and dying and starving in their homes because
mm-hmm.
they couldn't work, they didn't have money, and they really needed food. And so they did a food drive, I think a couple of food drives in Guerneville, one at the senior center, and then the quilt was brought up here to Santa Rosa, and they did a food drive there, and then they knocked on people's doors that they knew needed the food, who had AIDS, and said, the food fairy's here, and handed them groceries. And from that beginning of a few, you know, community activists, it grew to, you know, and of course the need grew tremendously very, very quickly in this area. Sonoma County has the highest rural population of people living with HIV in the county. And so it just, you know, the epidemic just took off and the need became greater and greater. And so they, you know, they incorporated as a nonprofit, and they got a space that a couple of blocks from here in downtown Forestville, and it was all volunteers. And then Betsy Van Dyke was the first executive director, I think the first employee, and I think Stuart Schofield was the second as the volunteer manager.
Mm-hmm.
And just again, as the need grew and grew, they needed a bigger space, and lucky to have the financial kind of support in the community, they did a capital campaign and bought the land and the building here, knowing that having the security was really important. And mm-hmm. so they raised the money to do that, and, you know, every year since, the number of people that we served has grown. So, but like I said, we've remained very grassroots and volunteer-run, tried to keep to the founding principles of treating people like adults and with respect, mm-hmm. and made to feel welcome no matter how they've gotten HIV. And one of the other wonderful things about the agency is that so many of our clients also volunteer here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes a really big difference to clients, that there isn't, you know, there's one kind of people on one side of the counter and another on the other. It's very much a community. And when especially people come in who are newly diagnosed with HIV, for them to know, especially if they're feeling uncomfortable coming to a food bank or uncomfortable, not adjusted to having the diagnosis and what it means because of the stigma that there still is,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that the person taking their order may very well be somebody who's also living with HIV. It's mm-hmm. a model, and it's it gives the people a way to give back to the community, and it also really creates community.
Certainly. How does one go about volunteering at Food for Thought?
It's really easy to become a volunteer here, and we really depend on volunteers. So we have a full-time volunteer manager named Elisa Baker, and she does a one-hour orientation on the third Tuesday of every month, except the month of December, at 7 p.m. at the food bank. And so calling ahead is great, but you could just come by on the third Tuesday of the month at 7 p.m. in our community room. And she does an orientation, explains all the different possibilities of what one can do as a volunteer here. And then she meets one-on-one with everybody to really find out what's a good fit, what people want to do, how much time they want to spend. We have volunteers who do weekly shifts. Some do a couple of shifts a week. And then there are people who do, you know, a food drive or a couple of food drives a year, or there's a particular fundraiser. Like, there's certain people who, they just come and do something at Calabash, or
mm-hmm.
Or Ambassadors for Dining Out for Life, which is our other really big fundraiser. This year it's actually taking place on World AIDS Day, which is Thursday, December 1st. And that's a really big day for us, and we probably need about 100 volunteers on that day, because we have an ambassador at every one of the restaurants. So calling the food bank, could I give the number now? Is
absolutely.
That a the number here is 707-887-1647, and that's the number to call if you know somebody who would be interested in our services, if you are somebody who could use our services as a client, if you were interested in becoming a volunteer, if you wanted to make a donation of any kind, if you wanted to buy a ticket to Calabash. That's kind of, that's the all-purpose number, and we'll set you up in whatever you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And there's also all sorts of information on your website, which is?
The website is www.fftfoodbank.org.
And it's a great website, lots of information.
Thanks. Yeah, we're trying to keep it updated, and it is. There's information about how to volunteer, how to become a client, how to make a donation, about the work that we do, and about the special projects that we're doing and special events, fundraising
mm-hmm.
events.
And we just have a few minutes left, but you touched on Dining Out for Life. tell our listeners about that a bit and how they can get involved and find out more about it.
Yeah, so we're hoping to have about 75 restaurants this year. I think we had 70 or so last year. And it's really, you know, it's another one of those days that just people in the community, the generosity is really incredible, because these restaurants give us either 25 or 50% of everybody's food bill, and some do the food and alcohol bill. They give that straight to the food bank. So there are restaurants throughout the county, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and anybody who goes to eat at one of those restaurants will have, the restaurant will donate a percentage to the food bank.
Mm-hmm.
We also have ambassadors, those are volunteers that are at all the restaurants, and they approach the tables, the people who are eating at the restaurants that day, and, you know, tell them a little bit about the food bank, find out if they're there for that event, or if they've just happened in, and it's an opportunity to let them know about our work. And also, we always have great raffle, you know, round-trip tickets to places mm-hmm. and things like that. So if people fill out their information on an envelope and we have that, we do a drawing, and that's great. And there's, of course, the opportunity to make a donation for guests to make a donation while they're eating there. That's become our biggest fundraiser of the year, and it's something
it
we really, really count on. The fact that it's taking place on World AIDS mm-hmm. Day this year is really wonderful.
Nice, nice. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and thank you and everyone else at Food for Thought for the great work you do.
Thanks, Gary.
And we want to thank tonight's guests, Rachel Gardner from Food for Thought, also director Andrew Hay. Next week on Outbeat Radio, hosts Jeff Besham and Greg Moralia will be here with Outbeat Now. I'll be back next month on Sunday, October 16th, with guests local therapist and author Jan Ogren and San Francisco-based artist Lenore Chin. I encourage you to listen to Outbeat Radio every Sunday night here at KRCB, 8 p.m., public radio, and we wish you a great week ahead. Good night.
Hi, this is Outbeat Radio host Greg Moralia, and I'd like 1 minute of your time to get you excited about some of the great reasons you should support KRCB Radio with a donation right now. We are your community's radio station. As a Sonoma County resident myself, I'm both a show host and listener. In the morning, I rely on Mark Prell in Morning Edition to learn about what's going on in the world and on Highway 101 during my commute. As for music, KRCB offers a show covering just about every genre of music you can imagine. And if you're a big-time foodie like me, then you probably look forward to hearing about the latest locally made cheese or wine on Mouthful every Sunday night with Michelle Anna Jordan. And then there's Outbeat Radio, the North Bay's longest-running show for and about the LGBT community. Join me right now by making a fully tax-deductible donation to KRCB Radio, your best source of original programming. Call us right now at 707-584-2020.